Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There's an old problem in medicine. It's called polypharmacy. When no one is keeping track of all your prescriptions from your doctors, your dentist, and what you're buying yourself over the counter. Who's looking for bad interactions or bad combinations? Or checking to see if you still need to be taking them at all? Now some doctors and pharmacists are pushing for change. This hour on Point, the move to de-prescribe. You can join us on air or online. How much medicine is in your cabinet? Does your doctor know exactly what you're on or tell you when it's time to stop? Later in the hour, we'll look at all the new research showing babies need germs to thrive and how too few germs mean too many allergies. First, joining me from New York City is Laura Landreau. She's assistant managing editor at The Wall Street Journal and writes the journal's Informed Patient column. Her recent column is called When Patients Take Too Many Pills, Doctors De-Prescribe. And you can find a link on our website, onpointradio.org. Laura, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Jane.
So give us a working definition from your perspective. What is polypharmacy?
Well, I think we're used to being in a prescribing culture in the United States. There's all these new drugs coming out, new therapies, and everybody wants to get the latest thing. And what happens as you get older and if you have multiple chronic conditions, it's very likely, and if you have different doctors, that you're going to have a lot of prescriptions. And pretty soon it's more than five, and sometimes it gets up to 10 or more. Mm. And that's what polypharmacy is, and that's what everybody's concerned about now.
I think in your piece it said 40% of patients in their 60s take more than five medications. One in six older adults now regularly uses potentially deadly combinations of prescriptions and over-the-counter medications. These are significant numbers, Laura.
Right. Well, especially since we're prescribing ourselves a lot of things. You know, we go to the supplement counter and we see this fancy herb and that supplement that we think is going to help us. We don't tell our doctor we're taking it along with other things. So you have drugs interacting with each other, supplements interacting with each other, and pretty soon you've got all kinds of side effects and risks.
And what are the dangers? What are the side effects of too many drugs?
Too many drugs can do things like, for example, if you're taking blood pressure medications, you can suddenly have too low blood pressure. It can be driven down too much. You can have fatigue. You can have weakness. If you're older, you might be at higher risk for falls. Certainly, if you're taking antidepressants and you decide you're going to try an herbal supplement like St. John's wort, all of a sudden those two things are going to interact with each other, and they can actually have some very, you know, very big problems, you know, cognitive issues, all kinds of confusion, memory issues. So there's a lot of reasons to, A, be very upfront with your doctor about what you're taking, and also make sure there's somebody, one doctor, that knows everything.
Hmm. Are there certain conditions that lead to the overprescription of medications, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and such?
Absolutely. You know, first of all, if you've had cancer, you've already been on a lot of toxic medications, and then you add other things. Diabetes and heart disease, it's the same thing. You know, one of the problems is that so many patients are multiple chronic illness sufferers. They have more than one thing at a time, and many of the medications that they take will have the same side effects. So it's kind of like a multiple effect of those side effects.
Give us an anecdote or two from your reporting, Laura, and examples of polypharmacy and the dangers associated with it.
Well, obviously, a lot of the people are much older, but I actually found it with a younger person, a woman that I spoke to, Janice Taylor. She's only 57. I still think that's young. Had a stroke in 2011, a heart attack in 2014, and she found herself taking about a dozen medications, and she had fatigue, nausea, dizziness, memory and judgment problems. So she actually started being a little more proactive. She's kind of very smart. She does volunteering for the American Heart Association, has a stroke support group that she facilitates. And so she asked her doctors, what can I stop taking? So they changed her blood pressure medication that was causing her pressure to fluctuate. They were looking at, you know, powerful prescription medications for migraines. Those were giving her hallucinations. So instead, they substituted an extra strength over-the-counter medication. And she also reduced the dose of a muscle relaxer that she had to take because of these involuntary muscle contractions. So it's often, maybe you're not going to stop everything, but maybe you lower the dose. Because the question is always, am I taking too much? Are the risks starting to outweigh the benefits of what this medication is doing for me?
Hmm.
Here's Lynette Martin. She spoke to CBS News in 2013, a 52-year-old woman telling Dr. Jonathan LaPook that she takes a dozen prescription drugs on a daily basis.
We have levothyroxine, which is for thyroid.
Okay.
52-year-old Lynette Martin takes so much medicine, she's lost count.
Regularly, I take 11, maybe 12.
It's 12, plus 4 over the counter.
Laura Landreau, the body processes drugs differently as we age, right? That plays into this as well.
Absolutely, because suddenly your liver isn't metabolizing things as quickly. You have more fat than muscle, and that actually affects the way medicine is metabolized. And, you know, you do have more cognitive issues. And, of course, older patients disproportionately use more prescription and non-prescription drugs than other populations.
What efforts are underway in the United States and in Canada, around the world for that matter, to fix this?
Well, Canada's actually been kind of in the leading edge on this. They have a Canadian deprescribing network. Now, it's a single-payer health system, so obviously sometimes they can do these big initiatives, you know, without having to get 75,000 people to agree on something. But they actually aim to reduce inappropriate medications by 50% by 2020 in Canada. And you also have a lot of efforts in the United States, the American Geriatric Society, different groups that really focus on older patients. There's a Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. They are giving CME credits to doctors who take rational deprescribing courses. Every conference you're going to go to nowadays for older patients, doctors who treat older patients, it's almost always going to include something about deprescribing.
Mm. Laura Landreau is the assistant managing editor at the Wall Street Journal and writes the journal's informed patient column. Laura, great to have you with us. Thanks for the information.
Thank you.
Joining me now from Ottawa, Canada is Barb Farrell. She's co-founder of the Canadian Deprescribing Network, very much on the front lines of this movement, a pharmacist at the Briere Geriatric Day Hospital, where she co-leads the Deprescribing Guidelines for the Elderly Project. She also teaches family medicine at the University of Ottawa and the School of Pharmacy at the University of Waterloo. Barb, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So we just heard a good rundown from Laura Landreau about all this. Good medications, bad combinations can be very dangerous, even deadly. Is this a problem mostly for the elderly, or are children and young adults at risk as well?
Well, I see the problem primarily in the elderly, although I'm surprised by the number of times I've been asked that very question. So I think it is something that we need to look at in all age groups around making sure that medications are working well and not causing problems.
Help us understand step by step the different ways this problem arises. How do we end up being over-medicated?
Well, I think it happens gradually. We know that most medications are started because there's a clear purpose to either alleviate some symptoms or slow the progression of disease. But the challenge, particularly as you get older, is that you develop more chronic diseases, so you get started on more medications as per various guidelines, and then maybe some of those medications might cause a side effect, which then gets treated with another drug, and we call that a prescribing cascade. Then this leads to drug interactions, multiple effects. For example, you might have three or four drugs that are contributing to falls or several medications that are contributing to confusion. And it just becomes challenging after a certain amount of time for the prescriber and the patient and the pharmacist to kind of figure out why and when all the medications were started and how to start reducing the doses or stopping them to try to minimize some of the side effects.
So is this a problem of too many medications or too many drug interactions?
I would say both. We know that the more medications you're taking, the higher the likelihood of having falls, and that is partially due to additive side effects, which could be considered drug interactions. So I would say both. It's the number of medications and the drug interactions and the prescribing cascades that they end up causing.
You must come across many stories of patients going into decline because of polypharmacy. Give us a couple of examples.
Sure. So I work in a geriatric day hospital where we see patients over 65, and they're primarily referred because they're having falls and cognitive impairment. And that's what really prompted me to get into research, was seeing the effects of reducing and stopping medications and how more often than not confusion would clear, people would stop falling, their balance would get better, they would feel more alert. There's so many examples. I'm thinking of a patient just recently in whom we stopped a single drug, amitriptyline, and he immediately felt more alert during the day. He was able to get back to writing a book that he's been working on that he had to stop working on because the medication left him feeling really very clouded during the day. Hmm. So sometimes just a simple change, a reduction in dose or stopping of one or two medications can be beneficial.
You're tackling this issue in Canada with great success. Tell us what you're doing.
Yeah, so I'm working with Dr. Kara Tannenbaum and a number of other individuals across Canada on the Canadian Deprescribing Network. And what we've done is we've pulled together patient advocates, healthcare professionals, academic researchers, and other healthcare leaders across the country. We've had two networking meetings to date, and we've developed an action plan over the next 4 years with five different subcommittees working on issues around raising public awareness of the problem, raising healthcare provider awareness and building capacity, looking at policy change, looking at how we can use our electronic medical records better, and then also developing a research agenda around the issues of polypharmacy and deprescribing.
Isn't it easier, though, with the universal pay structure to keep track of all this? It must be harder, I would think, in the United States, where our healthcare system is so different from yours.
It would be easier if we had a comprehensive electronic medical record for patients that clinicians could access. But right now we have a number of different electronic record systems, and not everybody has an electronic record. So it's actually can be quite challenging for a clinician to know exactly what their patient is taking.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the deprescription movement this hour, the push to finally get all of your doctors, specialists and pharmacists and you on the same page when it comes to your medications. You can join the conversation. Does your doctor know what you're buying over the counter? Is he or she trying to wean you off the drugs, the meds you don't need? This February, Radio Canada asked caregiver Sharon Jackson why her elder care center last year decided to cut down on the use of antipsychotic drugs with their patients.
The medications actually don't have any effect other than sedating the residents.
No effect other than sedation. My guest this hour, Barb Farrell, co-leader of the Deprescribing Guidelines for the Elderly Project and co-founder of the Canadian Deprescribing Network. I want to bring another voice into the conversation now. Dr. Michael Steinman joins us from Berkeley, California. He, too, has been involved in the push to deprescribe. He's a professor in the Division of Geriatrics at UC San Francisco School of Medicine. He co-chairs the American Geriatric Society's BEERS panel, which puts out a list of drugs inappropriate for older adults. Dr. Steinman, Michael, welcome to you. Nice to have you with us. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Jane.
So with a growing percentage of people combining drugs without their doctor's knowledge, tell me what you're seeing there on the front lines.
Well, we see a lot of problems that arise in clinical practice. And you had talked before about whether these issues affect mainly older adults or children or middle-aged adults. And it's really an issue of multimorbidity, that is, people with multiple chronic conditions. It doesn't matter really how old you are. It really matters how many chronic conditions you have, because that, by and large, correlates with the number of drugs you often end up taking. And across the board, increasing number of drugs are associated with almost every different type of prescribing problem that can arise in adults. This includes problems such as side effects, problems with medication adherence, taking your medications as prescribed, understanding what your medications are for, having problems paying for your medications, and the list goes on. Mm.
There's so many stories associated with this problem. A colleague this morning was telling me about his 91-year-old father with multiple health issues, was on 37 different medications, went into hospice. They decided to scale back some of the medications. It actually improved his condition. The moral of the story, multiple chronic conditions, multiple doctors, it gets complicated, right, Dr. Steinman? I mean, what's the best approach for a doctor?
Well, it does get incredibly complicated. And one of the challenges is that it's not just the problem for an individual doctor. It's the multiplicity of doctors. That person who you referenced probably didn't get 37 medications prescribed by one prescriber.
Right.
They probably were seeing 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different physicians and got those medications from all these different sources. And it's difficult for any one doctor to kind of get a handle on that. And it's really become incumbent over the last few years, as the number of medications has risen, for one doctor to really sort of stand at the forefront and manage the entirety of a patient's medication regimen, not just take off their little organ system that they're interested in and forget about the others. And the primary care physician is really the person best situated to do that.
You heard Barb Farrell talk about this earlier. With technology as it is today, you'd think that computer record systems could keep track of all the medications that a patient is taking. Why can't record systems automatically scan for potential interactions? What's the barrier there?
Well, there are a few challenges. First of all is that patients see different doctors in different health systems and might get their medications from different pharmacies. And so there's not one single repository where all those, where every single one of a patient's medications are entered into a common system. And then you add on top of that medications that patients might get out of the formal prescribing system, for example, over-the-counter medicines or herbal supplements or other natural therapies, and they don't make it in there either. And one of the additional challenges is it's not just enough to have a list of medications all in the same place. It's someone actively taking a look at those medications to make sure there are no harmful interactions, there's no unnecessary duplication, or there's no medications which don't really need to be there anymore. And that's beyond the capabilities of a computer. It really requires a thoughtful clinician to help with that.
A thoughtful clinician and maybe the patient themselves. I mean, you mentioned this. So many people self-treat today with over-the-counter medications and herbal supplements. Sometimes we forget to mention those medications and treatments to your doctor. I guess it's up to the patient to really be responsible for that to some degree, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the single biggest thing that we can do to help with this problem is really to kind of remember that the patient is front and center. If you think of a given person might see 6 different doctors in 3 different health systems and get their medications from 2 different pharmacies, and the only link between all of those activities is the patient. And they're obviously the one with the most incentive to get it right and to make sure they're being properly cared for. And a lot of times in our healthcare system, the patients have taken a relatively passive role. They go into the doctor tells them what to do, and they do it. And I think we really need to re-envision the role of the patient as being a much more active manager of their medication list and really engaging their doctors and their prescribers in conversations, not just say, okay, I'll take that medicine you're telling me to, but really ask, do I really need this? Let's go over the other medications on my list, see if there's something else we can take off. Do I have any questions? Let me proactively ask my doctor or my pharmacist or nurse about those. And so it's really important for the patient to play an active role, because if they don't, it's much harder for someone else to step into that role.
Phone lines are lighting up here. Let's go to Kitty in Strasburg, Virginia. Hi, Kitty. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, I'm glad to be here with you.
Thank you.
My comment is that open communication with the patient is the utmost. I worked for many, many years, all of my career in healthcare, as a certified medical assistant, x-ray tech, and most of those years was spent working in family practice. One of the things that we were to do each and every time that we escorted a patient into the room to see the physician was to interview them about their medications. They were encouraged to bring their bag of medications with them each time, even if they'd just been there the week before. But even if they didn't bring them, it was our responsibility to interview them. Have you seen another doctor since you were here to see, Dr. X? Have you added any herbals or naturals to your medication regimen? Are you seeing a chiropractor who has added some, supplements?
Yeah.
And so oftentimes we would catch things that they would not think to take to help the doctor. The other thing is, too, and in regard to the physician who just spoke about the patient being more active participant in telling the doctor, if they're elderly, they don't know, and they need someone who will advocate for them to speak with the doctor and say yes.
That's a great point, Kitty. Thank you so much. Dr. Steinman, you really do need an advocate if you're older, and even if you're struggling in middle age with some of these things, it's a lot to juggle.
It is a lot, and I completely agree with everything Kitty just said. I think, first of all, an advocate is critical for someone of any age. It's hard for any individual to manage these things by themselves and keep all the questions and the issues kind of clear and centered in their head to ask during the very limited period of a clinician visit. So having someone at your side, a loved one, a friend, someone who knows what's going on, can be incredibly helpful. It's obviously especially important if someone has problems with cognitive impairment or difficulty communicating. But even for anyone else, it's always good to have a second set of eyes and ears. And then the other thing that Kitty said, I think, is also essential. This should not be viewed as only an issue between the doctor and the patient. You know, doctors have very limited time, and it's unrealistic that the doctor alone is going to be able to solve all these things. So bringing in other members of the healthcare team, pharmacists, nurses, medical technicians, everyone has to be part of the solution, and it really needs to not be exclusively thought of as an issue just for doctors.
Here's Scott in Groton, Massachusetts. Hi, Scott. Glad you called. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. I just wanted to pick up on that thread about trying to coordinate different specialists with general practitioners. I'm a toxicologist. I do non-clinical drug safety in the pharmaceutical biotech industry. And the concept really resonates with me because, you know, there's a lot of push for personalized medicine, and we're trying to develop, novel breakthrough, changing therapies in these small orphan spaces, really, really niche, mechanisms of pharmacology. And it sort of adds to the collective challenge of having specialists understand these new drugs, how they work, and then trying to sort of layer it against the background of, normal stuff. Things that general prescribers do, blood pressure, easier stuff. It's a really very, very challenging area for us to think about in the industry.
Great question, Scott. Thank you. Barb Farrell, I'll bring you back in here. How do you coordinate among specialists?
Well, that can be challenging. It really is, in a lot of ways, up to the patient, I think, to try to keep track of the medications that they're on. I've seen increasing numbers of patients coming into our practice recently that have a good list of the medications that includes the physician who prescribed the medication. That can be really helpful for someone who's trying to do the coordination, whether that's a family doctor or in a geriatric day hustle clinic like ourselves, because we can then get in touch with each physician if we have a question about the medication or we think we might want to lower a dose or stop something. I want to point out for the listeners that there's a great information sheet on a website called safemedicationuse.ca. It's got 5 questions to ask about your medications, and they're pretty simple. If people can take that handout with 5 questions, asking about changes in medications to their healthcare provider, whether they should continue a medication or stop it, how to use it properly, what to monitor to know if it's working and what side effects they might be having, and what follow-up is needed to assess the effectiveness of the medication. If people could ask those questions of their healthcare providers and then write down the answers to those questions and keep track of that information and then share that information every time they see a different healthcare provider, that would help the healthcare providers know more than just their list of medications, but it would also give them an idea of what the plan is for that medication. And that's really important for healthcare providers to know.
Dr. Michael Steinman, what about dentists? They prescribe a lot of medications, right? How do you coordinate a dentist with a primary care doctor?
I think it's largely the same issue. It's oftentimes the dentist might be in a different healthcare system, but that might be true for 2 different doctors taking care of the same patient. So I think the issues are largely the same.
Let's go to Steve in Lincoln, Nebraska. Hi, Steve. You're on the air. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much for taking my call.
Yes.
I had a massive heart attack and stroke several years ago. After being a very healthy person most of my life. And, of course, I was immediately thrust into the quagmire of the healthcare system. and was prescribed. I was on 17 medications at one point, and became very suicidal and attempted to take my life at one point. And the psychiatrist, who happened to be on call the night when I went in, he said, well, why are we on this? Anyway, bottom line was he took off around six medications, and my condition improved dramatically. And I just want to say, you know, we have to somehow solve this riddle of when we have multiple specialists involved, because it really, you know, I could have succeeded, and God knows where that would have left. But thank goodness for this kind psychiatrist who realized and who was on top of mm-hmm. all the latest research. So anyway, I just want to say thank you for bringing this situation to the masses, and let's see how we can get this situation addressed.
Good, Steve. Thank you very much for the call. Dr. Simon, I mean, it just brings us back. You hear stories of patients going through a major decline functionally, cognitively. You know, take them off a few medications. It's the meds, right? It's the medication.
It often is the medications. It's not always, and that's mm-hmm. one of the challenges. The problem is a lot of the side effects of medications, the problem they cause, mimic underlying conditions. So if someone is suffering fatigue, lightheaded, dizziness, a general sense of ill well-being, you know, that might be an underlying condition, either medical or psychological, or it could be a medication. And a lot of times it's very difficult to parse them out. Mm. One of the challenges has been historically we as doctors in the medical profession have traditionally thought about diseases and conditions as the cause of these symptoms. So a patient might come to us, they complain of these symptoms, and then we start thinking about what diseases it could be, and then maybe add another medication to treat that symptom or that disease, not realizing that that symptom is actually the side effect of a medication they're already taking.
Right, and Dr. Steinman, the significant number of tests that are given for those symptoms that turn out to be caused by the medication, I mean, the costs add up.
Exactly. So it's the tests, and it's all the healthcare consequences of A, not having your symptom adequately treated, then B, adding yet another medication to the mix because you're doing the wrong thing. So what we really need to do is, you know, and this is where patients can really be play an important role here, is always think of the medications first. There's a nice adage, which I like to sort of teach to people who I help to train, and that's that any symptom in an older adult is a medication side effect until proven otherwise. Hmm. Now, there might be cases in which that symptom is not a medication side effect, but you're never going to know unless you consider medications and rule those out first.
Here's Maggie in Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Maggie. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I work in Cleveland Clinic Health System. I'm in their mail order operation, which is sort of a central processing location. We do a lot of maintenance medications, long-term supplies, and our pharmacists are actually very involved in the process of overseeing how patients are taking multiple medications from multiple prescribers. We have instituted an adherence packaging program where we actively seek patients who have multiple chronic conditions and are on many medications. And this allows a pharmacist to work directly with the patient and be on top of the records from their various providers and get their multiple medications in the right dosage at the right times delivered to them in a way that they can easily take and keep track of.
Mm. Maggie, thank you. Barb Farrell, it sounds like Cleveland Clinic's got a way of figuring this out. I mean, are hospitals and doctors kind of doing this on their own, kind of ad hoc where they can?
Well, I think the system that Maggie described is pretty widely used in terms of blister packing medications together for appropriate timing and administration. It's the oversight of having the clinical pharmacist involved in looking at the benefits and risks of each medication in that particular patient that I think is really vital. And echoing what Dr. Simon said earlier, one of the things that we're taught in pharmacy school in terms of our sort of diagnostic ability is to ask the question, can this be caused by a drug, of every symptom or sign that we see. And that helps us identify drug-related causes of problems. And then we can go through a process working with the prescriber, and this would work well in Maggie's system too, for a really planned and supervised process of doing.
We're talking about the efforts underway to de-prescribe in the medical profession. More after this break, including your calls. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Blue Apron, providing pre-portioned fresh ingredients with easy recipes delivered to your door. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping at blueapron.com/onpoint. Blue Apron. A better way to cook.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the problem of polypharmacy and a solution, de-prescribing, this hour. My guests this hour are Dr. Michael Steinman, professor in the Division of Geriatrics at UC San Francisco School of Medicine, and Barb Farrell, co-founder of the Canadian De-Prescribing Network. Let's go back to the phones. Amy in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, you're on the air. Amy, welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I think this is a really great topic and really relevant. I come to it as both a patient myself and also my mom, who's in this demographic you talk about. She's in her mid-60s, and she's on at least 10 different medications for multiple autoimmune diseases. I see this world up close, and I think it's so important that we're trying to do this important work. I had a question for your guests. Both as an experience, my father, who's my mom's primary, advocate, if you will, she was a nurse herself, so she's very informed. But they've been looking for years to try and find a practitioner who will be that central point, like your guests have been talking about. And she's got so many things that they've had a very hard time finding a clinician who's willing to do that. So that's one point. And then my question was, I wonder, it hasn't come up in the conversation, but I wonder too, would it help if we had more of a root cause approach where we, I know we always look at the medication and that's a good approach and often right, but sometimes I wonder if we just took a root cause to try and understand and also expanded the options that we look at, whether it's nutritional interventions or other, more holistic approaches, if that would also help us reduce the number of prescriptions that people are getting as patients.
Amy, thank you so much. Dr. Michael Steinman, to Amy's first point, how do you find a good doctor who can actually manage all this?
Great question, and I don't think there's an easy answer. I think there's maybe two things, though, that maybe we can do to help with that. The first is that, picking up something I was saying before, I wouldn't look exclusively to the doctor as the sole person who can help with this. Even if the doctor is maybe not ideal at this, there's oftentimes a pharmacist that person might work with or another healthcare professional who can do those services. That can be a pharmacist who might work within the physician's practice, for example, if they're in a large multi-specialty health organization or an HMO. Or even a community pharmacist. And if yourself or the person you care about is on Medicare, they're over 65 and they have a Medicare Part D prescription drug plan, many of those will also provide some services, often done over the telephone, that can help with these things. Another thing, if you are looking for a good physician, oftentimes geriatricians are particularly attuned to that. So if you're dissatisfied with your physician, you can look for a geriatrician in the area who's might be good at this.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are relatively few geriatricians out there practicing in the community, and there's certainly not enough to meet the demands of all the patients who might need them.
And quickly, Dr. Steinman, a root cause approach, a more holistic approach to how we look at medication.
Well, I think that's another great point. I mean, the caller had mentioned, nutritional approaches, and I think those have a role. I think it's important to think, though, before we think about adding new things, like adding new nutritional therapies, it is useful to take a step back and see what we can take off of the regimen before we're thinking about adding new things.
Let's get Jennifer in here from New Orleans, Louisiana. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. I'm just here to discuss that this also happens to younger people with chronic illnesses, like
okay.
we were discussing.
Yep.
My sister is 44 years old. She's been chronically ill for 15 years, and now we're facing cancer. She just got diagnosed with breast cancer, so, more medications. She's currently on, 10 medications. And I just think that it's so important, like you were saying. I think that we've had interactions, we've had hospital trips due to interactions and due to side effects of medications that were, you know, unpredictable. Mm. And I think that it's not just, like we said, it's not just the demographic we're discussing where the elderly are involved, but specifically disabled people and younger people that have health problems.
Jennifer, thank you. Dr. Steinman, how does the process of deprescribing work? How do you go about it quickly?
Well, I think the first element of deprescribing is really figuring out what medications, including over-the-counter medications and supplement, a person is actually taking, because it's very hard to deprescribe unless you know actually what they're using. And that includes what they're actually prescribed and then among what they're prescribed, what they're actually putting in their mouth. And so we often recommend what's called a brown bag review as the first step. And what that is, the person puts all of their medications in a bag. Oftentimes, it's got to be a big brown shopping bag because they have so many medications and won't fit into a smaller bag. And that includes everything they're prescribed, everything they bought over the counter, every herbal medication, and bring it to your doctor or your pharmacist and go by through each medication one by one to see what that person is actually taking. And that can reveal huge discrepancies between what the different doctors or pharmacists think a person might be using and what the patient actually understands they should be using. And that's an essential first step.
Would you add anything to that, Barb Farrell?
Well, that's exactly how I would start with an assessment. And then I would look at each medication and ask myself about the effectiveness of the medication and ask the patient about the effectiveness, go through common side effects that medication can cause, try to understand the time frame around when the medications were started and when side effects started, look at the drug interactions between them. It's a fairly complex assessment to identify those medications where we could either reduce doses or stop them. And then I would work through a really planned and supervised process to gradually reduce drug doses. And the reason we do that is that there are some medications that have withdrawal effects. And so I also want to warn the listeners to be cautious about simply stopping a drug. This is something that needs to be done in concert with your healthcare professional so that they can help you monitor the effects.
Right, because Dr. Steinman, you stop taking a drug suddenly, that can be very dangerous, can worsen symptoms. You've got to gradually taper down over a period of time. Is that right?
Absolutely. It depends on the kind of medications. There are certain medications you can just stop from one day to the next and not cause any problems. But there are many others that Barb alluded to, which really will cause a problem due to sort of symptoms of drug withdrawal if you stop them abruptly. So understanding which medications you can stop and how to stop them and how to stop them safely and what to look for when you're stopping them, how to see if you're having withdrawal side effects, how to see if the symptoms that the drug was supposed to treat are coming back up again. Those are all essential parts of the deprescribing plan that needs to be thought out in advance so the person really knows what they're doing and can act appropriately if they're experiencing a problem. Mm.
Great conversation. I want to thank my guest today, Dr. Barb Farrell, a pharmacist at the Briere Geriatric Day Hospital, where she co-leads the Deprescribing Guidelines for the Elderly Project, co-founder of the Canadian Deprescribing Network. Barb, great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Dr. Michael Steinman, professor in the Division of Geriatrics at UC San Francisco School of Medicine. Doctor, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
In a moment, we look at new research on why infants need a little dirt to grow up without allergies. This is On Point. Are kids too clean today? One of the big new fronts in medical research is the study of the microbiome and how the galaxy of germs in our bodies keeps us healthy. More and more research shows that infants who are exposed to germs have fewer allergies. Joining me now from Detroit with the details is Christine Cole Johnson. She is an epidemiologist and chair of public health sciences at the Henry Ford Health System. She co-authored a study recently published in the journal Nature Medicine that links allergies in children to too few germs in infancy. Christine, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Jane. It's great to talk with you.
So our awareness of the importance of the microbiome has been growing for several years now. Feels like, though, we're still on the frontier of this field of medicine. What are you learning about infants, microbes, and allergies and the microbiome?
You're right. It is a brand new a field in many ways. It's just been in really not even the last decade that you can measure the microbiota all the different bacteria and other organisms in samples like babies' stool samples so that you can really look at this. So this is really new. There's been suggestions in the past that babies and their mothers being exposed to less than sterile environments is a good thing for the immune system, and this work is sort of diving down to figure out why that is.
So what are you finding? Why is that?
It seems that, what we're finding is that there's definitely a evolutionarily driven process, we think, that the baby's gut microbiome develops in a pattern over time. There's actually now known to be some microbes even in utero that the baby's exposed to, not too many, but during birth and then afterwards the baby gets a massive exposure to bacteria and has developed to accommodate that.
So this notion that infants who are exposed to germs have fewer allergies, what kind of germs are you talking about? Does this mean I let my kid go out in the backyard and eat dirt? I mean, what exactly do you mean?
Well, we're trying to figure that out, actually. There's been studies done since, almost the last 20 years, I'd say, that have shown that kids that grow up on farms, especially where there's livestock exposure, mostly these studies have been done in Europe, in Bavaria, but also in the U.S. there's been some studies, and also pets in the home have been shown to decrease the child's risk for allergic sensitization, for example, atopic dermatitis, asthma. And so all of these suggested also exposure to non-pasteurized milk that's used sometimes in Europe. All these kids are at lower risk for these conditions. And now the thought is that it actually is associated with certain bacteria. We're trying to figure out which ones that might be or what kind of patterns we're talking about here. This paper that we just published was looking at different patterns and found one particular pattern seemed to increase risk for these outcomes.
C-sections, you found, also have a negative impact on an infant's biome, a new baby's biome.
Yes. In fact, there's a lot of factors in the environment, also behavioral, medical, that seem to impact the baby's early gut microbiota. We have another paper, actually, that came out in Scientific Reports that looked specifically at what factors in the home or the mom's behavior change that pattern, and we found a lot of them. We studied, almost 40, and about 20-some all impacted that microbiome.
So bottom line, going through the vaginal canal, the birth canal, and the exposure to germs in that cycle, in that event, actually is good for the baby.
That's right. Maybe that's why we have labor. Not just us, other people have shown this too, that the child who's born by C-section, especially if it's elective, it seems to have a microbiota that's more similar to the environment, more similar to the mother's skin, whereas vaginally born babies acquire a gut microbiota that's more similar to the mother's gut and vaginal microbiome.
And doctors are actually swabbing children born by C-section. What does that mean? What are you doing?
There is a group in New York, in fact, that published a study that looked at that. It was a small group of kids where they actually did swab babies born by C-section with secretions from the mom's vagina. And, you know, that study looked like it was going in the right direction. I think a lot more work needs to be done because it was small, but it was very interesting.
Yeah. What about the Swedish studies about dishwashers causing allergies?
Oh, yeah. Yes. There's interesting studies coming out of Scandinavia. They always do great epidemiology there. They have shown that homes that have dishwashers, which are, you know, perfectly designed to sterilize eating utensils, those kids had more allergy and asthma than the kids where their moms and dads washed the plates by hand.
Mm-hmm.
There's also another study where they looked at pacifiers, and they looked, apparently a lot of people, I guess I did it too, the pacifier would drop on the ground,
yep,
and the mom would stick it in her mouth to clean it and give it back to baby. The moms that did that, their kids had less asthma.
Tell us about the Amish kids that you studied.
Ah, yes. That's another, that study's actually out of this country. It was in New England Journal recently, showing that the actual environmental microbiota is different in Amish kids versus Hutterite children. Hutterites are also similar in many respects to Amish folks. They have a pretty close community, but they're more modern in their farming. And so their microbiota environment was more similar to the normal environment than the Amish one. Mm. And it seemed that the Amish, well, the Amish children, there's less prevalence of asthma. Mm.
What about all the sterilization that we use, the hand sanitizers, the wipes? What did you find with regard to that?
You know, we actually did not look at that in our study, but I would, just on a, just from my knowledge of the literature and also just opinion, I think they're not that great of an idea. A lot of factors here, such as the use of antibiotics, even just looking at my list here.
Well, dogs in the house, too. You mentioned dogs in the house are actually,
yes,
a very good thing.
Yes. So actually, we were one of the first ones to show that having multiple pets in the house very much decreases your risk for being sensitized to allergens. Mm. And that's been shown over and over again. So it seems that, you know, close experience with dogs and cats is a good thing.
So what are you working on now, and what more do you hope to learn in this area? It's fascinating.
Well, one thing we're doing is the children that were in the study that we published, we are bringing them in now. They're about 10 years old for an extensive examination and evaluation for asthma and also overweight and other pediatric conditions to see if these associations hold out over time. We have a study where we're just analyzing it now, where we linked up with people who are involved with rescue dogs, and we measured the environment of homes before a dog was adopted into the house, and then a year later, to see how the animal actually affects the environment of the home, specifically the microbiota.
Well, thank you so much, Christine Cole Johnson. I'm going to go easy on cleaning my house. You've given me a good excuse. Thank you very much, Christine Cole Johnson, epidemiologist and chair of the public health sciences at Henry Ford Health System, joining us from Detroit. Much more. Thank you very much, Christine. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.